the phone and is now in the possession of the armor.
Come diligence for these contacts after being.
Okay, we'll receive it firmly anyway, okay?
There's two of them and they
stayed
the exact same spot both times. They're outdoors, I can say that.
Oh my god, I hope that's a plane. Oh Jesus, please be a plane. Oh please. Alright, Lisa, are you ready for this?
Cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular disc.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead. Doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, good day. Welcome to our listeners around the world to edition 361 of Strange Days Indeed, the program that observes and reports on the phenomena that surround one of the greatest mysteries that humanity has ever faced, UFOs, unidentified flying objects. This program gives you the opportunity to expand your mind and hear from and about credible people who've had incredible experiences. Tonight, now let's see how many people we can cram in the studio type of program. Tomorrow here in Toronto is the UFO Disclosure Symposium at Convocation Hall. And the speakers include three of our in-studio guests tonight. Joining Victor Vigiani and I are, in alpha order, UFO lobbyist in Washington and disclosure proponent Stephen G. Bassett, UFO researcher, author Richard Dolan, and renowned UFO researcher, author, and the godfather of Roswell, or is that the grandfather of Roswell, Stanton T. Friedman. Good evening, gentlemen. Welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Evening, Earl.
Hi, Earl.
Good evening.
It's good to finally meet you all. It's good to have you in studio tonight.
Absolutely. I'm very glad to be here.
Oh, thank you, Rich. And
first time to Canada in my life.
And how does it feel?
I'm staying.
Stephen Bassett is staying. Stanton Friedman has been here, what now, 27 years?
25 years.
25 years. And you come to Toronto on occasion, yeah?
Yeah, I go through it. I have to give Air Canada a chance to lose my luggage. The last three times through here going home, my luggage arrived the next day.
Was that Air Canada or one
yes.
of the... Yes.
Oh. Unfortunately.
Well, there goes another advertiser on these stations. I don't want you guys to scoop yourselves for tomorrow. So perhaps we can talk around what you're going to talk about tomorrow without necessarily doing that.
I think that's a great idea.
There you go.
I just want to remind everybody to be there, you know, at 9 o'clock because there could be a lineup. But,
well, you've had the most astounding publicity.
We can't believe
I saw
it.
Your face all over television.
It's been amazing.
All over the newspapers. Mike Bird was in the Globe and Mail this
that's
morning.
That's right.
Amazing press reaction to this.
Yeah.
It's, I think it's the most we've ever had to any sort of UFO-related thing in this, in Toronto anyway.
So, and let's hope it means that the press is getting more interested than they used to be, rather than they want to do anything but Katrina and Rita and what's going on in Iraq and all the bad stories. Let's take something a little lighter and go to UFOs.
The thing is, nobody knows whether the story of UFOs is good or bad. We may not like the answers that we hope to find out eventually.
That's a horrible thought.
Could be quite true.
You mean we're going to find out something worse than what's going on now?
Well, it could be way worse. I mean, didn't you see War of the Worlds recently?
No, I did not see War of the Worlds.
Neither did I, believe
I'm,
it or
I'm
not.
Boycotting Steven Spielberg until he funds the exopolitical movement.
No.
That's my position. I'm holding my $9 out.
And he's missing your $9
yeah,
like
he
crazy.
He was just listed in Forbes magazine as, I think, the 67th richest person in America, like 2.6.
Billion.
And most of that money, $6 billion, most of that money was made doing movies on extraterrestrial themes.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of them, Close Encounters, Alan Hynek was a consultant and appeared a cameo.
Yes, he did.
So I would say that E.T. is probably 80% of his net worth, and we could use a little of that net worth out here in order to get the truth out, and also to pursue the truth in the post-disclosure world as it is, because I don't think the government's going to just roll over and start dishing out drain loads of documents. I think it's going to be a fight to get clarification of what happened in the last 50 years and what we're dealing with and so forth. And, mm-hmm. and that's going to take money. It's going to take a citizen effort. It's going to be an exciting time. But mm-hmm. nevertheless, we need support. And Steve's on my list. Now that I've seen Forbes magazine.
That's Stephen Bassett's take on Steven Spielberg. Steve Bassett brings up an interesting point. Okay, so we get disclosure. Then what? We five sitting here in studio going to do after that?
Watch the stuff hit the fan big time, because this would be as big or bigger, I think, than the shakeup of the Soviet Union. I mean, you have a reality and a secret that is so utterly massive that involves probably an enormous amount of resources in terms of people and money. And, you know, people are going to start wondering, hey, what's been going on all these last 60 years? And I think a number of heads politically would roll.
It's kind of interesting to me, having just come back from China. I was in Hong Kong and then at a world UFO conference in Dalian, China. And I got a prize for my paper, Government UFO Lie. Now, you might think the Chinese would appreciate that, because I was talking about the American government primarily. But it gives you pause when you go over there to realize that, okay, we're talking disclosure about flying saucers. But let's face it, there are more Chinese on the planet than any other variety of person. How are they going to react? What are they going to say? In the back of their minds, they've opened up on UFOs to the extent that for a while it was never talked about in China. It was like there was an embargo. You don't talk about UFOs. Now they're encouraging people. The articles over there, there were some while I was there, some in English language papers as well, were very open and very above board and talking about the professional level of people in the Chinese UFO society. And it's a big society, and their newsletter is going to 400,000 people, which is kind of a huge mailing list to my mind.
That's a big one for sure.
It's bigger than a UFO update.
And so, yeah, a little bit. And so I'm kind of curious. I mean, I spoke in Hong Kong. Their lecture was a sellout a week in advance, more than a week in advance, $10 U.S. equivalent. And they had over 300 people. And there's going to be a big article in a Chinese magazine coming up. The guy just emailed me about it. So I wonder what the Chinese approach to this whole business is going to be, because they have different axes to grind than the other governments, I believe. I think they're trying to be open. Maybe that will encourage other governments to be open, become almost respectable, partly because the press has played the straight cards. Mm-hmm. These are professional people. They're taking it seriously. And they're not going, ha-ha, silly season is here again, as was so often the case in the West.
Yeah.
And whether they're trying to get Western governments to speak out about what they know, I don't know. I don't think the Chinese government has itself put much data on the table. But the fact that they've left the door wide open for the Chinese UFO Society, the Hong Kong UFO mm-hmm. Society, I did 7 interviews. There's a lot of coverage. And I talked to university professors. They were very interested. And so that's a part of the world we tend to forget about. Now, we have this India Daily stuff that comes out all the time, and I don't know what to make of that.
I tend to just leave it alone. I used to put it on the list. It sounds too much like World Weekly News. Or,
Weekly World News.
Yeah. I didn't want to name the paper properly. Oh.
Well, leave it to me. No, but I think that we're at a time when other things are happening in the world. Look at there are 3 new television shows that are about aliens, as I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot at one time, isn't it?
Yeah.
I have, for reasons unknown to me, been called about doing interviews for television specials a whole bunch the last few months. I was flown down to Roswell to do an interview. It's 3 days of my life, but for the Travel Channel. Discovery England flew me to the Betty and Barney Hill actual abduction site. Did a long interview with the Toronto group in Roswell during the festival, 7 hours out in the sun. what are these guys doing? Why all this interest now? What do they know that we don't know?
Or what do we know that they don't know?
Well, apparently somebody thinks these are going to be winners, that they've got a market for this stuff. And that's good news for somebody who's so heavily steeped in ufology as myself. But what does it mean about the larger picture? Does it mean there's a change going on? We're being mainstreamed?
Well, we were talking about that earlier this afternoon. Like Steve was mentioning that the unfolding plan of all of this, that could be part of a plan. The metaphor you were using was there's a plan, they want to pursue the plan rather than tip over the train. Isn't that what you were talking about, Stephen, earlier?
Well,
they don't want this to be sudden, they want it to be gradual in the way this information comes out.
I'm assuming this because it's certainly been gradual. The point I was making is we can assume that the people that control this information and this issue in government, remember, we're just talking about information. We're talking about underground facilities. We're talking about vehicles, research, ongoing stuff. This is not just a couple of documents in a tin can somewhere. There is some sort of plan regarding this coming public. I've assumed that from the beginning, almost certainly. There are people that tell me, no, it'll never be public in 5 lifetimes. That's ridiculous. I think they probably were concerned it might be public many times since 1947. And I think they also know they're running out of time. I'm certain that they know they're running out of time. And there are a lot of indications. Stanton is a good indicator as to what's going on, because if things are bubbling, he's going to be one of the first people they're going to call. So he's getting a lot of action. Well, I'm seeing other indicators. People are coming forward that you wouldn't expect. Behind all of the foo-fah in the world, which is always going on, the disasters, the wars, the general stupidity, this continues, along with other important issues as well. And if I'm the government and I'm facing global warming and hurricanes and wars and religious wars and suicide bombers and all the rest of this, which is generally making everybody ill, and I'm sitting on this paradigm change, it starts to look real attractive, right? Because I assure you that if the disclosure goes down, the channels are going to switch. People are going to turn off the war, and they're going to turn off the hurricane, they're going to turn off the Michael Jackson trial, and they're going to turn on to CNN, ETs, 24/7. 1 billion Chinese and the people of India and a whole lot of other people that have never set foot in the United States are going to get in front of their television, and they're going to know everything that's going on about ETs. They're not going to give a darn about who broke what law 10 years ago or 50 years ago or what technology we got. They want to know about ETs. They're going to get very excited, and it's going to change the story. And we need a change of story right now. So, again, I see things fundamentally still moving towards the disclosure event.
Stan was saying there's a big media shift, but I have to point out that it's not only with UFOs, it's the whole paranormal thing. I mean, you look at the number of new ghost programs, a lot of fantasy happening in amongst all of the reality programming that's going on.
Well, I would contend that the paranormal shows are more real than the reality shows. The reality shows are not, they're surreality shows.
Yes.
They've bridged us finally. But there is no paranormal. I don't believe in the paranormal or the supernatural. I think both of those are misnomers that we use for our convenience. The world is what it is. Mm-hmm. It's all normal. We're just getting around to some of it.
Yeah, getting our heads around to understanding.
Whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, I caution people not to get overly worked up about this. It's going to be a big deal in some ways, but not as big as you think. Humans, if anything, are able to adapt and take for granted anything. A guy marries the most beautiful girl in his entire high school, and in 5 years he's taken her for granted like you wouldn't believe. You get a $50,000 Mercedes, and after 6 months, you're bored with it. We invented air flight. Within 10 years, we were bitching about airline food. ETs will be announced on Monday. By 2 weeks later, people will be going, you know, this is getting a little dull.
Yeah, and the gas prices are still going up.
Yeah, and they'll start complaining about, no, we will adjust. However, will the world change? Oh, huge. And does it need to? You betcha. And in the reconstruction of our world in the post-disclosure will be the opportunity to get some things right that we don't have right now, if we're wise. Or we can take all this new information and the new technology, and we can screw things up at an even more accelerated pace. Ultimately, I don't think the universe cares. It's up to us to make these decisions. My only job is to ensure that we have as much information when we make these decisions, as opposed to being treated like mushrooms, right? You know, every once in a while they lift the lid and dump some manure on you. Other than that, you don't hear anything.
And they keep you in the dark.
Yeah, that isn't the deal I bought into when I became an American.
In studio, Stephen G. Bassett and Richard Dolan and Stanton T. Friedman, whose Top Secret Magic is being reissued tomorrow, a new edition, Stan Friedman.
It just came out this month, and it's got a 5,000-word additional chapter debunking the Majestic 12 documents debunkers.
You've been digging around Richard Dolan in archives in Ottawa?
Yes, just for the last 3 days. I was up in Ottawa going through records of primarily the National Research Council. It's a funny thing because just yesterday, before I was ready to leave, the last folder I went into had this really strange letter. I wrote it out, and I've put in a photocopy request for it, and I assume that I will get it. But when I came here in Toronto today and saw Stanton, I said, "Hey, Stan, you know, I saw a letter about you in the Ottawa archives," and I mentioned this, and he had no idea. I thought that this was probably well known. Turns out it's not known at all, and it's a very nasty, mendacious letter from 1980 by the former UFO debunker Philip Klass. Klass just died a few months ago. This is just amazing because I have the letter he wrote, and I have an internal memo that circulated in NRC as a result of this. I'll just read the salient parts of it. It's dated August 15, 1980, and it's to Dr. A.G. McNamara of the Hertzberg Institute of Astrophysics, and I was with the National Research Council in Ottawa. They accepted all Canadian UFO reports at that time. So here's what Bill Klass writes. "Dear Dr. McNamara, I regret that I must bring bad tidings in your UFO responsibilities," that's in quotes, "but trust that like the proverbial messenger, I shall not be executed for doing so. I have reason to believe that Canada will soon gain a noted ufologist, full-time UFO lecturer of the snake oil salesman variety, who will soon move to Canada to become its chief UFO guru. I can assure you that you and your associates will be publicly accused of a UFO cover-up, or cosmic cover-up, as he is prone to say, that dwarfs the Watergate scandal. His name is Stanton Friedman. Since the early 1970s, he has earned a comfortable living on the lecture circuit, mostly to junior colleges and the like. His lectures are very colorful. His one-hour lecture is so filled with half-truths and falsehoods that it would take me several hours to offer a rebuttal. And like wrestling with an octopus, when you manage to pin down one leg, the other seven are still thrashing about." He goes on. He says, "I am enclosing a white paper which I prepared a few years back that illustrates the man's modus operandi and his distortion of facts. Please treat this letter in confidence, sharing it with appropriate associates as you see fit. Cordially signed, Phil Klass." As mendacious as it is, it prompted this internal memo as a response that is also available, signed by some man in the NRC. He says, "I don't know what we can do to prepare for the arrival in Canada of this man, Friedman, but if he acts as Klass predicts, we can ill afford the publicity he will generate for us. Since there is no science in the study of UFOs, perhaps we should think again about the possibility of turning the so-called UFO file over to somebody with no responsibility for the conduct of scientific research." So, I mean, this is, you know, Klass, this, and Phil Klass had done this before. He did it back in the 60s when James McDonald got Office of Naval Intelligence money to research UFOs, and Klass intimidated those guys at Office of Naval Research, and he did the same thing here. I don't know how effective it really was, because
Stan's in the country.
Stan's in the country, and NRC continued.
I moved here 2 weeks
UFOs.
Later, so he was really on track. I had told people I was moving, but
what
you notice there's no mention
man
of my
is.
Being a scientist in there, even though he's writing it to the NRC. Yes. Furthermore, I have never accused the NRC of being part of the cosmic Watergate.
I wonder
in other
if
words,
he was
the charges didn't pan out, and I didn't know about this letter, so I wasn't trying to avoid him.
Got to wonder if he was trying just to intimidate them in some manner to frightening them away from the UFO research. I mean, this is part of the response that was elicited. They weren't really thinking, what can we do to Stanton Friedman? Mm. But they were thinking, we should really drop this issue right now and not deal with it, which clearly they weren't doing anyway. They were getting all these UFO reports, and if you get this kind of attitude from a government agency, what does that mean they were doing? They were getting some amazing UFO reports that Canadian citizens were reporting for years and years, which clearly were not being investigated by anybody.
They only cared about the meteor sightings. The non-meteor ones, mm-hmm. which I'm interested in, we're all interested right. in, they did nothing with. And I've been to the NRC, and I've been to the National Archives many times in the early years, And I didn't take note of the fact that the Canadian files, unlike the Blue Book files, didn't have any of the crazy, far-out, irrational stuff. And lots of good RCMP reports, for example.
Yeah. Mm.
And the archives people were always cooperative, too.
Yes.
I made several trips there back then.
All of those files now go to Chris Rutkowski, all of the reports.
The new report.
And interestingly enough, Rich Dolan digging out that letter by Class to the National Research Council, I'm sure you're all very aware of the name Larry W. Bryant.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
He filed a FOIA request, according to an email from him posted to the UFO updates list today, to the FBI, asking for all the information that they have on Class.
I filed one with the CIA about a week ago.
Oh, really?
And my next column in the MUFON Journal is my take on Class, and I'm so glad I wasn't very pleasant about it.
In lieu of Phil Class's recent demise, I thought I might work up a letter of my own, and so I've got a few things down here. Dear St. Peter, I'd like to inform you that you're about to receive a noted UFO researcher, and I just want to caution you that he is a tricky fellow, and that whole controversy about the Nicaea Council and everything, he's going to debunk the hell out of that, so watch this guy very closely. I'm working on it. It's a draft.
Yeah.
Right, but we'll see. I'll try to get that up. No, I was thinking that all I can say is if Larry Bryant does get a response from the FBI, that they include Phil's pay stubs from the NSA. I mean, that would be nice, you know, if they could do that.
Phil Class has been long suspected by many, many, many people who have been some kind of government operative, CIA, whatever. And you really have to wonder, I mean, the tone that he struck in this letter, what is he really doing here? Why write such a letter?
No, it's proactive.
What an underhanded, but he knew right to who to write it to. He knew just...
Sure.
He got wind somehow that Stanton was about to move.
How did he know that?
It's an interesting question. And
he said he heard secondhand. I read
secondhand from the NSA. Yeah.
There are a couple of little passages that I didn't read on the air, but he did indicate I heard secondhand.
Phil did write the NSA. Back in 1997, I had heard that they were going to release a new package of NSA UFO documents. Previous to that, they'd released this heavily blacked out affidavit justifying the non-release of 156 UFO documents. And I heard from somewhere that they were going to, because of a new executive order signed by President Clinton, making it tough to keep old classified documents classified unless you could justify it again, old meaning more than 25 years. So I called the NSA, Freedom of Information Office, and I told the gal my name. And she said, yes, I know who you are. And I said, oh? She says, yeah, I have a memo in front of me from Philip Class in which he says that we should try to show something that isn't all blacked out because Friedman shows these documents on television, the blacked out affidavit that was 80% blacked out, perfectly legitimate to show them after all. He shows them and doesn't say that they're blacked out because of sources and methods information. I mean, here he's insinuating that 80% of an affidavit to a federal court judge justifying non-release of these documents is all sources and methods information, which doesn't make any sense at all.
It's everybody's address and their mother's address and their dad's address and their grandparents' address. It's all blacked out.
And, yeah. You know, they did then,
right.
Thanks to Phil, I suppose you could say, they sent me the new package, and the affidavit, instead of being 80% blacked out, was only 20% blacked out, proving why did they black out all that other stuff before. But much more interesting, they released 156 UFO documents. Well, sort of. There was a little note there that said whiteout has been used. And if you look at these documents, and I'll show some tomorrow, you will see that you can read one or two lines per page. So to say that these are released is rather misleading, to say the least. And I've had people in ufology at that time tell me, well, see, Stan, they're not holding anything back. There's no cover-up. I said, can you read beneath the whiteout? Well, no. I said, then they are. You're telling me sources and methods is 95% of these documents? It makes no sense. Why are they filed under UFO? You know. So Phil has, in the past, made other efforts. We know about Jim McDonald. We know this attempt to get the NSA to recognize that Friedman is the enemy because he shows these blacked out documents. And you notice they listen to him. That is, they put out a much less highly redacted version.
Well, he was a respected writer for, maybe an editor by then.
Senior avionics editor.
Yeah, and a connected guy. So, of course, they look, there's a larger issue here, some of which will come up tomorrow in the symposium, and that is that I can't count how many times I've been asked, how is it conceivable that government interaction with the issue of extraterrestrial phenomena, the actual presence of extraterrestrials, could be somehow maintained as a non-mainstream item of discussion for 58 years? How is it possible? Oh, here's how it's possible. A man of Donald Menzel's stature agrees under his duties as an MJ-12 man to debunk the issue publicly, even though he knows otherwise. People like Phil Klasser signed on and either paid or they do it out of patriotism to debunk the issue in order to keep it under control. Carl Sagan cuts a deal with the government that he will not allow this issue to go forward or he will not support it in return for we're not sure what, though it probably might have been not money, but it might have been matters that he considered important. The top networks, I am absolutely certain, have cut deals with the government that they will not address this issue, and I include in that the major newspapers, the Washington Post in particular. I'm saying it right now. Come sue me. These people are too smart and too connected to have missed this. So if they're not covering it, it's because they have agreed not to do it. So that's how you get 58 years.
Well, we know for a fact, I mean, just leave the field of UFO research for a moment, no need to speculate that for many, many years, CIA and has been known to have infiltrated major U.S. media. And this has been known at least since Carl Bernstein wrote a great scoop on this back in 1977. House investigations of the U.S. House of Representatives also uncovered CIA manipulation of mainstream media through the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, and 70s. Hundreds of mainstream American journalists, people with CBS, Reuters, Time Life, were on the CIA payroll covertly. Okay, CIA in the aftermath of that said, well, we don't do that anymore. Well, what that meant was they don't have formal paid relationships with a lot of these people. But they did, even in the mid-90s, have a proviso saying, well, you know, for certain exceptions and matters of important national security, we will have relationships with media. So does that mean that the CIA or some other deep black agency controls the media wholly? Well, no, of course not. Doesn't mean that with hundreds of people working for you, you can wield amazing amounts of influence when you need to. Mm. Sure, sure it does. And then you move to the UFO field, and what does it look like? Well, this is exactly what it looks like.
You couldn't control the coverage of something this big simply by staffers on CIA payroll. You got to get that through the top. I mean, you have to get an agreement from the owners of the particular media in that
case. That's right, yeah.
But you'd also...
It's easier today than it was 50 years ago when corporate media is so much more centralized than it was back then.
Well, let me give an example of a cover-up that was fairly extensive. This past week, for the first time, the National Reconnaissance Organization, which normally keeps a very low profile, even though they're a multi-billion dollar a year organization, proclaimed, whatever you want to say, they certainly did it proudly, that they had operated the Poppy, P-O-P-P-Y, look it up on Google, plenty, satellite. And it was a spy satellite. There were nine of them launched between 1962 and 1971. That's a long time ago. There were nine of them launched. The average life was 34 months. They were listening in on Soviet electronic stuff from the ships at sea. It's a big ocean out there. Now, they mentioned that they were working with other agencies, the NSA and Air Force Intelligence and the Navy and so forth. And it's just come out 43 years after the program began and 30 years after it ended. So secrets can be kept. That was a good-sized program. We're talking multi-million dollars, certainly, right. Maybe a billion or two,
mm-hmm.
for the NRO anyway. They like to spend money.
Well, that's the whole problem. Yeah.
UFOs are held secret in plain sight.
It's really incredible to have three people of this stature on the program.
Remarkable.
All at once.
And Richard Dolan, who 5 years ago, when did you get involved in all of this,
well,
Richard?
Well, my book came out about 5 years ago. Before that, I don't think anyone knew me. I
was going to say, 5 years ago, nobody had heard of you.
I wrote my book, suddenly here you are.
I
wrote it by stealth, as I sometimes would say. I got interested in this about 10 years ago, really with no knowledge of the UFO phenomenon. I had been doing graduate work in history, doctoral studies at the University of Rochester on Harry Truman and the Cold War. That was my thing and had nothing to do with flying saucers. And I think I got bored, I got interested, whatever it was. I thought, is this real? Is this nonsense? Like so many people at some point in their life have this question, what is going on with this topic? And I started out with a basic bibliographic search, just trying to find out, you know, conclusions I could make personally, and that snowballed into my 500-page Volume 1. Volume 2 will be out in a year, by the way. Volume 1 goes from the 1940s to the early 70s, and I try as hard as I can to make it a very straightforward, very judicious narrative without a lot of grandstanding, trying to elaborate what happened then, what happened then, what happened in a pretty clear historical way. And Volume 2 will take that UFO cover-up, UFO history, from 1973 to the present day. And I have a lot. Actually, I've got more research, far more research done on that than I did when I wrote the first book. So looking forward to getting that done.
And the last chapter is going to be about disclosure, when it all happens.
I have to figure out how I want to make that last chapter. I'll be talking about the implications of disclosure, no question about it. I certainly want to talk, I think, at some point about not simply as things are factually and provably, but what things may look like. I may decide to do a little bit of just analysis and speculation as well. I haven't decided how I want that to turn out.
Richard Belden, one of the speakers at tomorrow's UFO Disclosure Symposium that's happening at Convocation Hall. Also in studio with us, as I said, Stanton T. Friedman, and he's speaking there tomorrow, and the keynote speaker tomorrow is Stephen G. Bassett, and Paul Hellyer, former Minister of Defense.
Among other things.
Among other things. I mean, it started up a couple of political parties, several political, shall we say, brouhahas in the past. How do you guys feel about Paul Hellyer? I know you guys from south of the border really have no idea who this man is.
Well, he's a former Minister of Defense. This is very significant.
Yes, but he's admitted that he had a lot of UFO reports cross his desk during the time that he was Minister of Defense, but he wasn't really interested until after his political career. So I wonder what he will bring to the symposium tomorrow.
We're wondering, too.
Yeah. Obviously, he still has friends in high places.
One would think so.
Mm-hmm.
And every major network that I've been dealing with over the past week and a half has asked me just that question. Why and how did we get Paul Hellyer to come out to talk about this issue? The best answer that I can come up with is this man wants to talk about the issue. He wants to get the thing out and make it public. He wants to create the discourse that needs to be out there to talk about the truth.
But the general public should keep in mind, I mean, it's very significant that Paul Hellyer is making this public statement. But, of course, he's not the first major public figure to make pro-UFO, pro-ET-type statements. I mean, people who are in a position to know have been making such statements for many years. It's well known in the UFO research field, for example, that Apollo 14 astronaut Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon, has stated for a number of years that he has had several very elite contacts that have told him of deep black programs that are charged with studying alien technology and indeed bodies. And Edgar Mitchell says this man walked on the moon. Where has the major media been to flesh this out and to bring it out and ask? And basically, they've been dropping the ball since he's been talking about this.
I think it's significant that tomorrow we're going to have all that major media there in Canada anyways.
Yeah.
And for the very first time, a collection of media is going to be sitting in Convocation Hall at a university that's 175 years old. That's the seat of learning in our province, and if not Canada, with major media gathered there. And it's going to be a very, very interesting day.
You know, UFO conferences are such a variable in terms of who turns out, what happens, what the press coverage is.
Yeah.
I've been to a lot of them over the years. I've spoken at more MUFON symposia out of the 36 that have been done than anybody else has. And I was very pleased, incidentally, when you talk about tone of coverage in Denver in July, the press coverage tone was very friendly. I had an article about John Schussler before the symposium, totally straight.
We were talking research. Stephen Bassett was saying that he wanted Steven Spielberg to throw in some cash. If somebody came to you and said, look, I want to throw $500,000 into the kitty for research, would you be prepared to not mention their names in public?
Well, it depends. First of all, I'm not a researcher. I'm not looking for research money.
Yes, but you're connected
with people
who are.
I'm looking for political activism.
Okay.
No, I'm looking for activism money. In other words, I believe that the only hope for the research is to end the cover-up. Then the research money will be there in unlimited funds, all right, to explore this issue in every possible way. And hopefully those who have decades of research and time, like Stan, will be major players in a post-disclosure research. But let me put it this way. You could put millions and millions of dollars into more research, right? Huge projects to catalog crop circles. You know, check out those cattle mutilation. Archive all the, you know, the sightings that ever came into MUFON. All, you could spend a lot of money doing that, and it would advance this political issue almost nowhere. But a few million dollars aimed at the political issue, it's going to end the embargo cannot sustain even about $2 million, heavily targeted on it. And that's just the way it is, because this is not a scientific problem. Never has been. They've proved the issue years ago. It's been proven eight times over. So why isn't being studied in every university in the country? Because it has been politically blocked by an imposed embargo that says this issue will not be studied, will not be funded, will not be part of the mainstream as per national security directives. So it's a political problem. It is not a science. But does that mean the science should stop? No. But if you want to get forward with this, we need political money. And let me point out that we've never had any. There has been some money for the research. Over the years, nothing has been put into political activism, virtually nothing. And as a result, that's been very favorable to the embargo. And I believe that when there have been some instances where maybe some people might have been willing to put some money in, I think they were, how would you say, discouraged to do so. I have been kept off of programs because that politics is not allowed on those shows. Right. In other words, the politics is what really confronts the government, not I got a better photo. Right. See, I got a real good photo here. This is better than the other photo. See that saucer? All right. That's going to shake things up. They don't care about that. They could care less. But boy, you want to take $1 million and do a march on Washington, bring 100,000 people in here. That scares them to death. You run for Congress on this issue. That bothers them. You get down to the real politics. You start messing with the areas where you can really change. That gets their attention. So we need the money there. I mean, no disrespect to researchers, but the political activism has got to be funded. I mean, you realize where the environmental movement would be today if from the beginning it was like, well, you understand there can be no money. You can do it on your own, fund yourself, but whatever environmental activism you're going to pursue, it has to be done purely on casual funds. No institution money, nothing. Yeah. Well, let me tell you, we'd all be spooning our air, right? It would not be a very pleasant place to live. You cannot have social justice or move and advance the social good without funding. And the government's known that from the beginning, and one of the key things it's done is ensure that the amount of money available for exopolitical advancement is zero.
Well, the U.S. Federal budget for fiscal year 2006 is about $2.5 trillion. Of that, you know, ask yourself how much of this goes into UFO research. Probably, well, maybe at the classified level there is, but open public money, I don't think there's any.
Well, they used to put some money in SETI, but that was a front operation. I mean, SETI was a propaganda front, science front from
SETI
the day it was born.
SETI has nothing to do with UFOs, folks.
Right,
it's still
exactly.
an effort
totally
to investigate. It certainly isn't
but the government,
UFO related.
But the government did spend money on it, and that's a
they
little
don't
offensive.
Now, though.
Private donations. But right. there is another area where you could spend money and achieve all our objectives. I think if you funded the equivalent of a Woodward Bernstein team for a year, you could blow the lid off the cosmic Watergate. It does take money to do that. If you started with the Carol Bolander memo and all the blacked out and whited out documents, and somebody really dug into it, talking to people like those of us here, I think in less than a year you could produce the equivalent of a Pulitzer Prize. If it's down in the States, you could get one. And that takes money, too. People forget Watergate took support from the Washington Post. At one point, there were 16 guys working, digging out the numbers, you know, following the money, as the saying goes.
The people who do UFO research do this. No one does this full time, practically. It's very difficult. You can't make a living doing this. You do it out of love or out of hate, but you can't do it for money because the money's not going to be there to support you.
With the number of freelance writers that I've gotten calls from over the past 3.5 weeks, these people are chomping at the bit to get at this. They want to be there in the worst way possible. Not only have the regular mainstream media reacted and responded to it, but these people want to be there. We want to find out what's going on.
There is a hunger in the general public for this. I absolutely know this. People that I talk to who are just general public, they find out that I'm interested in UFOs. They go, oh, yeah, well. And I'll say, yeah, I wrote that book. I'm like in my office on my shelf. I've got a whole wall of UFO books. And what I find is people open up. They're very interested. They don't have a lot of knowledge, but they have a hunger for this. And when they find somebody who is willing to talk about it without being embarrassed and actually has some facts, people get very interested.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that they're missing something big from the official version of reality that they're being bombarded with every day. There is real potential for this to be a truly explosive issue. It's got to be presented in the right way for enough people to see.
Let me just caution that. It's been presented pretty well for many years. The interest in this subject from the very beginning was intense.
For enough people, I mean, for a wide enough population.
What I'm saying is that, again, that this external factor of the government imposition of the embargo, countering the efforts of the presenters and the researchers and the writers and the authors. I have to keep coming back to that. In the 1950s, there was enormous interest in this phenomena, and they had to contain that. And they did, by misinformation and planning tabloid stories and a thousand other things.
And mental books.
Right.
The interest remains, though. The interest remains,
but the government's job was not to allow that interest to convert to action. In other words,
right.
Be excited.
Of course. Yeah.
Go to a movie, but for God's sakes, don't fund a PAC. Don't go vote for somebody because they're interested in the subject, right? If you're a foundation, independent foundation, you're the chairman, don't grant anybody money to do
that. That's because knowledge doesn't always equal power. You have to have knowledge plus action, then you get the power. And it's like that with UFOs, like that with the Kennedy assassination, for God's sake, in America, where 80% of the people believe he was assassinated in a conspiracy. What difference does it make? The official truth is, you know, it was all done
right.
By one guy.
It would be very difficult for any member of government here in this country to say anything about this.
Of course, at this point.
Politically inexpedient.
Thank Christ. What's been going on for 58 years, and it's something they should hear about.
Heck, I think it's been going on longer than that in terms of the reality of this. One of the letters I was just reading in the archives the other day up in Ottawa, two letters sent in by very elderly Canadian citizens at that time recounting utterly extraordinary sightings that they had in the 1930s. One out in the Northwest Territory, out in the middle of nowhere. A very detailed letter by an extremely articulate man described in 1936 an object. He was out on a boat as part of a Canadian government project, and he thinks he was the only one who saw this. Perfectly blue sky, saw an object in the middle of the sky, couldn't make out how large it was because there was not a cloud in the sky. He saw it turn on its axis and then zoom, gone in an instant. You read this man's letter, it's just a letter. You can't prove it one way or the other, but he certainly sounded very credible. And there was another sighting from 1932 in Nova Scotia in a very undeveloped area. A man who had only seen two aircraft in his life up to that point, he was the age of 15, camping with his older brother. He says, we're at the edge of a pond. We heard this trembling sound. The ground trembled and the air vibrated. And a moment later, this object went zoom across the sky. But he got a good look at it, he said, and he actually described it as swept back delta-shaped wings. 1932. Beautiful looking craft, in his opinion. What can one do with letters like this? But it was a very articulate, and the man seemed like he was being sincere in what he wrote.
I got a call from a pilot today, responding to the Globe article, and saying that he saw that same incident that was described that Michael Byrd was talking to the reporter about. And he went on and on about seeing this thing and doing the sharp right-angle turn straight upwards after the craft darted up. The thing about pilots, they're excellent observers. They're paid to be observers. They're paid to be very careful of what they do. They have to, if you do something up in the air in an aircraft that's not right, you're going to find yourself in the bad end of a real bad crash. So these people have to be very careful about what they do and what they say. And pilots are among probably the best witnesses that we have.
The Belgian Air Force case with the flying triangle.
Yes.
You know, the witnesses who, and it wasn't just the pilots, there were thousands of witnesses mm-hmm. who watched those triangles.
Absolutely.
Chugging along at 80 knots and suddenly speeding up to 1,800 knots.
On the Belgian Air
Force
radar.
Caught on radar, yeah.
On one of those cases, the object dropped in altitude something like 5,000 feet in 1 second. It's about a mile, more than a kilometer in a second. According to the official Belgian Air Force records on that case.
And feathers and bricks don't fall at that speed.
No.
Hardly. Hardly. We talk about pilots, but there's no shortage of good reports from all kinds of people. Astronauts were mentioned before, and pilots have certainly been mentioned. But if you go into court and look for good witnesses, you want people who are credible. I'm thinking now of the Peter Jennings program treatment of Jesse Marcel, Jr. Here you have a man who's an Air Force colonel, still serving in Iraq, incidentally. He was called in at age 67, called back. He'd been in the reserve for over 30 years. He's a pilot. He's a medical doctor, a flight surgeon. Now, wouldn't you think those were aspects that would go to credibility for this witness? He was involved with the Roswell incident, of course. And I met with Jesse, and he doesn't resent being called back in. He loves to fly. Had an email the other day. He's coming back in November, but he is talking about becoming more active. Why didn't Peter Jennings' people mention any of those credibility factors? He was interviewed. They didn't say anything about being a doctor, a colonel, a pilot.
I think I know why. Because when you get that kind of information presented to you that he has, eventually that information gets inside of you and it festers. And you've got to realize at some point in time, you're going to have to politicize this issue. That's the point.
They're afraid.
They're afraid. And if you present the compendium of information and it sits there, it's left to be inert if you don't act upon it. And if you do act upon it, the only method that that information becomes energized is if it becomes politicized. And that's what I think has to happen. When you get that information, you move forward with it. You don't just stay with it. You don't hide your candle under a basket. That you lift the basket up and the light shines. And that's what's going to happen with this issue. It's going to become politicized.
I really wonder, after so many years of many people lying to themselves about this, that psychologically could be a huge problem in recognizing that, yeah, I've been wrong my whole life. I've been part of the problem for all these years. People don't want to believe that. We like to think we want truth in our society. We want information, but maybe we might want to think that we hate truth as a culture, as a civilization in many ways.
We have mere moments left on the program. Final thoughts, we have 2 minutes each. If you can watch the clocks in front of you, that would be useful, starting with Steve Bassett.
Well, I'm very pleased this has worked out as well as it has.
Mike Bird, got this going. Victor came on board, did a fantastic job media-wise, breakthrough media coverage. I'd like to see the U.S. imitate it. I think Paul Hellyer is going to be a milestone for Canada. He's not the first Minister of Defense or equivalent, I believe. I've said that, but in fact, I think Lord Hill Norton was. Keep that in mind. These are Ministers of Defense making very strong and powerful statements. Gee, it's going to register at some point in the public and the press, and they're going to say, wait a minute, let's get on this. But Canada has potential to have enormous influence on the United States in this issue, and I'm going to encourage Canada to do something, and you'll be hearing more about that tomorrow.
Thank you, Stephen G. Bassett. Stanton T. Friedman.
I'm looking forward tomorrow just because I have no idea how things are going to turn out. I'm not even sure what I'm going to say.
That's good news.
Hey, well, as a promoter, you know, of the event. Free-floating, I work from my slides and so forth. But
no, I've heard you talk before. I know you.
And this will be a different sort of talk for those who have heard my flying saucers are real talk. But one of the points I will emphasize, and several slides say it, is government UFO lies. And I will be being very specific about official statements that have been made that are in contradiction with the facts in the particular matter. Not just broad brush, well, they lie all the time kind of thing, but here's what they say and here's what the facts are. So I'll be trying to do a lot of that tomorrow. And there will be some things that will surprise people, I think, especially about 1952 and statements that were made about pilots shooting down UFOs, they should, was the instruction, and a general saying we have scrambled jets after UFOs hundreds of times. You'll see the actual newspaper article quoting that general. I think it's time to come to grips with the fact that lies have taken place. You can't say it's not a matter of national security. Then you're saying, well, we're instructing pilots to shoot down UFOs. If it's not a matter of national security, why are you telling them to shoot them down? I mean, you know, there's a contradiction there. So I'm looking forward, and I'm particularly as the only Canadian amongst the three of us. I mean, I'm a dual, so I could say I'm the only American who's a Canadian or the only Canadian who's an American, but here. But I'm particularly interested in what Paul Hellyer will say. Obviously, the media are interested, judging by all the articles I've seen, which is quite remarkable. And I wonder if he's got some new things up his sleeve that we haven't heard about yet, but that will turn up tomorrow.
Be there or be L7. And Richard Dolan.
Yeah, I think tomorrow is a great opportunity for the Canadian public and Torontonians who are able to come to this. If you haven't really been involved in trying to understand what this topic is about, I think this will be an excellent opportunity to recognize and to learn that this is a topic that really doesn't require a great deal of speculation. There is a tremendous amount of factual information that is available in terms of objects that have been encountered in my research that I try to look into by U.S. military, very provocative, confrontational encounters time and again, proving that there is a real thing going on out there involving real technology, and this is exactly how it has been dealt with by military personnel the world over, and in particular with the U.S. as I concentrate. So that there's a real historical reality to this, and no matter how you want to interpret it, there's somebody's technology that does not appear to belong to us. And this is quite significant, and maybe that's enough work for a day for someone who's just curious about coming in. I think it would be a real eye-opener for you.
And you yourself, Victor?
I'm a teacher by heart and by profession. And when you teach, you have to grab a hold of the mindset of the learner. If you don't understand where the learner is in the whole process of learning, then the teacher really doesn't have a good chance of relaying information properly and having it change the person's behavior. And that's what we're hoping to do tomorrow. I think we understand where the learners are in this, and I'm including media, and I'm including the general public in this. I think we've got a pretty good understanding of where people are in this, because the level of inert intellectual interchange that's been going on about this issue in the media and among the general public has been less than substantial, let's put it that way. So if we can create this new dialogue or this new kind of discourse or even present a new way of understanding this whole issue, as Richard is saying, we will, in fact, provide a learning situation for the media and for the general public. And when people learn something, that means learning happens. And when learning happens, behavior changes. That's what we're taught in teachers' college. You know, true learning is a change in behavior. If we can change people's behavior about this subject, then I think we have a good possibility of moving on to the next step of politicizing this issue to a point where our politicians will understand the public is becoming changed about this. There's a change in their attitude. There's a change in their behavior. So we have to start paying attention to it. And that's what I hope we achieve tomorrow in some small or big way.
That just about wraps it up for all of us tonight. I know you all have an early start in the morning.
Yep.
I want to thank you for coming in tonight to break a leg tomorrow in more ways than one, and hope that there will be some media people come out of there tomorrow out of Convocation Hall, wide-eyed, needing to know more. If you would like to know more about the conference, you can click the banner at virtuallystrange.net, Strange Days. Indeed, you can reach any of our guests tonight. They all will be speaking tomorrow at the Toronto UFO Disclosure Symposium at Convocation Hall. Thank you, Stephen Bassett, Stanton Friedman, Richard Dolan, and look forward to hearing you all tomorrow. And, of course, Paul Hellyer. I'm looking forward very much to hearing him tell me something absolutely amazing.
We've got 30 seconds left, and I want to thank you, Mr. Knapp, for doing what you've been doing. Excellent work.
It's my assignment whether I choose to accept it or not.
Well, you're a big part of this.
361 shows, as impressive as can be.
No matter how you cut it.
Well, it's good management doesn't listen to this program. We'll see you all tomorrow. And if not, then we'll talk to you next Saturday night. Thank you all. Good night.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli.